in the epistle of James is outlined, if you're a person who likes to start and to follow, have a thesis statement and then have it lined out point one, point two, point three, and so forth, then this book is not written like that. What happens instead is James starts out talking to his brothers, as he calls them, who are scattered probably because of persecution and difficulty. And he talks about one thing, and usually he'll come to the sort of the end of what he wants to say about that, and whatever he talked about last in that last paragraph turns out to be what he talks about next in the next paragraph, and so forth. And it goes from one practical matter to another one like that. I want to do our class today on the first chapter of James, the first 18 verses. And I want to tell you ahead of time that we're going to come back to parts of this next week and the week after that as we study. But I want to look at one overall theme in this section this morning, verses 2 through 18. And this is a sort of a what and a why and a how type class. And we'll kind of approach it that way. And the what here has to do with these two terms. In some of the versions, there's not a distinction made about how these two terms are between these two terms. But in most of the English versions now, there is a distinction between the use of these two terms. What, in your mind, is the difference between a trial and a temptation? Or is there a difference between these two terms? Eddie?
Trial, to me, is something that will go on for a longer period of time. A temptation may only be a spur-of-the-moment thing that happens 5 minutes or 10 minutes.
All right.
Goes away.
All right. So duration may be one of the differences between the two. I saw Brenda first here.
To me, a trial is a set of life circumstances that cause things to be difficult, whereas a temptation is a provocation to sin.
All right. One is a difficulty that you just is. The other may be something that would entice you to do the wrong thing. All right, David, let me ask this. Could a trial lead a person to do a wrong thing?
Temptation.
All right, a trial could be a temptation, but not every temptation comes in the form of a trial. All right, David?
Brenda pretty much said what I was
going to
say.
Oh, she did? Well, we know about brilliant minds, then, don't we, here? Any other difference that you can think of between temptations and trials?
Sometimes a temptation is something you cause it to happen.
All right.
And when you, a trial could be just a turn event.
All right. Very important point that she brought up, I think, is that a temptation comes more from within the person, or it can, and a trial, on the other hand, comes more from outside forces that maybe other people around you, or a problem you have to face, or Brenda used the term life circumstance. That would be a distinction. Any other?
I don't ever think of a temptation coming from God.
All right, and I think that's one of the things that James 1 is going to bring up.
He says that.
Yeah, he says that.
I just mean that I don't personally think that.
Yeah.
Anything
All right.
that happens and it's a temptation,
it's
my fault.
All right. Let me go ahead and put up here this question. Does God cause it or allow it? No, that's where we're headed with this. Does he cause it or allow it? Does that question have a relevance when you talk about trials and temptations?
Satan causes it, God allows it.
All right. James is going to say, okay, Connie?
Well, God gave me choice. So if I choose to go to Brahms and I have the temptation of an eggnog shake and I'm a diabetic, I've pretty well caused it and he's allowed it all the time.
All right, okay. Can you blame it on him?
Well, I could, but it really wouldn't be justified.
Okay.
The distinction that both of you are making, I think, is relevant a lot of the times. God, James is going to say, will not cause this one. Why is God not the cause of the temptation? Because God doesn't tempt somebody to do evil. God's not in the business of trying to get somebody to do evil. That's not his nature, and that won't happen. And does God place any limitation on whatever of this he allows?
Yes.
All right, in what manner?
You can't escape.
All right, with either a trial or a temptation, he will see to it that it's not beyond what we are able to bear, but he will provide a way of escape. Brother Feeney?
Can the so-called Lord's Prayer lead us not into temptation?
All right. That's a very good way of illustrating the point. God would not do that, and we can ask him to help us avoid what we're able to bear. All right, we'll run across that as we read this passage this morning. And then the third thing is, all right, how can I or am I handle both or either of these two things? How may I, both of these are going to be a part of life, and do these two things go away because you're a child of God and God is pleased with you and God is happy with you? Does he, if he's close to you, make sure that these two things don't happen in your life? Would you find God on TV saying, or anywhere else for that matter, if you'll just make this confession and draw near to him and so forth, he'll see to it that you are healthy and prosperous? No, see, James, that's one of the things about James. Let's read verses 2 through 18 and think about what James has to say on this matter. And this morning, with this text, if y'all don't mind, I'd like to read it if you'll follow along with us. James chapter 1, verses 2 through 16, and I'm reading this from the English Standard Version. Notice, count it all joy, my brothers, when you meet trials of various kinds, for you know that the testing of your faith produces steadfastness. And let steadfastness have its full effect, that you may be perfect and complete, lacking in nothing. If any of you lacks wisdom, let him ask God, who gives generously to all without reproach, and it will be given him. But let him ask in faith, with no doubting, for the one who doubts is like a wave of the sea that's driven and tossed by the wind. For that person must not suppose that he'll receive anything from the Lord. He is a double-minded man, unstable in all his ways. Let the lowly brother boast in his exaltation, and the rich in his humiliation, because like a flower of the grass he will pass away, for the sun rises with its scorching heat and withers the grass, its flower falls and its beauty perishes, so also will the rich man fade away in the midst of his pursuits. Blessed is the man who remains steadfast under trial, for when he has stood the test, he will receive the crown of life, which God has promised to those who love him. Let no one say, when he is tempted, I am being tempted by God, for God cannot be tempted with evil, and he himself tempts no one. But each person is tempted when he is lured and enticed by his own desire. Then desire, I think the word lust fits better here, by the way. Then desire, when it has conceived, gives birth to sin. And sin, when it's fully grown, brings forth death. Do not be deceived, my beloved brothers. Every good gift and every perfect gift is from above, coming down from the Father of lights, with whom there is no variation or shadow due to change. Of his own will he brought us forth by the word of truth, that we should be a kind of first fruits of his creation. Now, you can see when I read that why I say that we're going to need to come back to several paragraphs in this reading. But you also can observe, if you think about it, that it's the whole section is tied together by this thought here. Notice verse 2. The first thing he says after greetings is when you meet trials. And then notice in verse 12, he talks about remaining steadfast under trial. And then in verses 13 and 14, he talks about temptation. Why one is tempted and how one is tempted. And when he talks about not being deceived, I think he ties it together, that together with what he has to say about God. All right, now, what I'd like for us to do then is to take a look through this passage and see what we can find out, especially about this last point. How does a Christian go about handling trials and temptations? All right? And let's approach it that way here. And let's start in verses 2 and 3 with this thought here. I get to identify the thoughts, and then you get to add to them and think about them here. The first thing I would think of here is to endure, but to look for ways to grow through this. Look at verses 2 and 3 to start with. What does John say, or James say, about the first thing to his brothers, about how they should act when they meet the various kinds of trials?
Count it all joy.
What does that tell you immediately about the nature of Christian joy?
You enjoy it to be fun.
All right, it is not backslapping fun, is it? You hear people talking about all the warm, fuzzy feelings that we describe as joy, and there's an aspect of that to joy at certain times. But what about joy when you meet various kinds of trials? If it's not just feeling good, no, nobody's, man, I am so happy that I've got this terrible obstacle here that I have to contend with. That's not what he's saying. So what does it tell us about joy? All right, there is a peace to it. And there is a feeling, it seems to me, or a conviction in this, that in the providence of God, this is something that I can endure, and when I have come through it, I will be the stronger for it. That seems to me to be the nature of what James is saying here. What are some of the various kinds of trials that a Christian may face because he's a Christian?
Family members turn away from him.
All right, there may be issues like that. Can you think of any others?
It could be financial, because right, you may choose not to work someplace.
All right, in the case of James, if they were scattered by persecution, we talked last week about why James brings up the rich as much as he does. I think what Linda just said was a real problem with these people who received this letter. They They had no way to make a living because, often, because they were Christians. Can you think of any others? Daniel?
There's governmental.
All right. Exactly. With the Roman rulers, that happened to Christians a lot. Any other things? What are some of the various kinds of trials you may face, not just because you're a Christian, but just because you're a person?
Illness
obviously would be one of those things. The disappointment of it, expectations that didn't come about like you had hoped. That's one. You mentioned family with regard to because you're a Christian. Sometimes our difficulties in that area of life just happen because we're people. The responsibilities of making a living and of dealing with neighbors and with living in a community. All of those things are various kinds of trials. Brother Feeney.
I lifted up my voice in prayer every night this week. Had a $2,000 water leak in the house.
Oh my goodness.
One car quit and my HMO canceled me.
Jan, you might want to move to the other side. That's life, you know, isn't it? It's what Brother Feeney is saying.
And then I go to sleep on the couch with four men running in and out everywhere. I said, I can't do a thing in the world.
You just go right ahead. You've heard it. What's Murphy's Law?
The king go wrong, it will go wrong.
And have you heard the commentary on Murphy's Law? Murphy was an optimist. and Brother Murphy here could tell us that. All right. Look what he says now. How do I handle it then if I can expect there to be kinds of trials? James refers to it in verse 3. How? How does a Christian look at these trials? The testing of your faith. All right, does everybody see that? How does a trial test a person's faith?
There are a lot of people I know who would say, like, they're having a hard time at work, that that's God telling them they shouldn't be in that job.
All right.
They need to be doing something else.
All right.
It's almost like the first instinct is to run away from it.
Yeah, I kind of wanted to run away
from it. Yeah, John?
It's easy to be a good Christian when everything is perfect, when the blessings are flowing down upon you. It becomes a lot harder to be a Christian whenever you don't feel those blessings.
Alright, that's the test. The test of the genuine, Peter in 1 Peter 1 talks about the test of the genuineness of the faith, shows up by these trials. You guys ever see, this will date me considerably, but it will describe my intellectual level even more. Were any of you guys Underdog fans? You remember some of you, the old cartoon. You remember what Underdog used to do? What, the humble shoeshine boy, when they'd give him a coin, what would he do? Bite down on it to see if it was genuine or not. That's what trials do to the faith. They show now. Is this a good timer who is in it for what he can get out of it? Or is this somebody who believes that God is God and Christ is his son no matter what? Now.
He can run it any way he wants to.
That's right. Is God God or am I God?
Yeah, he can do anything he wants.
And that's the question. Now, how can a person successfully regard trials as the testing of his faith? What does James tell us to do? And by the way, this may mean what he means by counting it joy. It may describe what he means by counting it joy. At the end of verse 3 and verse 4, how does he tell us to think about these things? That's not too hard a question.
Ask for wisdom.
All right. Before that, even I think that's important. But before that, look, he wants us to realize, and this is realistic here, The testing of your faith produces steadfastness. Harper's been staying with us this week, and I learned something yesterday afternoon when Carrie got back that could possibly have been a mistake that we've been making. Carrie put her down for a nap and let her cry a while. I didn't know you could do that. I thought that when she whimpered, you're supposed to go pick her up. And I wasn't realizing that the testing of your faith produces steadfastness. Maturing requires steadfastness, doesn't it? I mean, and there's no way, is there an easy way to gain steadfastness? I'm afraid not.
I did lay down with her.
And oh, you. Well, I don't think you're as mean as I am. All right. Verse 4, look at it. Let steadfastness have its full effect. Look at this. Its full effect that you may be perfect and complete, lacking in nothing. Now, what he's getting at there is that in order for steadfastness to have its full effect, we have to stay with the Lord all the way through the trial. We come out of it more mature and stronger. And this same thought, by the way, occurs in Romans 5, if you guys remember, at the beginning of the chapter. It's a principle of life. And that's the reason I use the illustration of watching a little one grow. That's why students go from one grade or one course level to another. Brother Feeney is about a graduate level this week with the trials he's been through. You kind of see. Now, let's any comment about 2 through 4, then this point here, Brian?
Well, kind of a side note here. These are Christians that are scattered.
Yes.
And so it's been real easy for them to just, well, if we don't say anything, we're not going to suffer so much. We're not going to have persecution. And he's encouraging them, hey, you're scattered, but it's okay. Keep doing what you're doing.
I think that's a good point would be for them to blend in, not make the trial go away, but also been pretty easy to give up because, you know, if you're scattered or not very many, there's not a great deal of support around. I mean, why'd you get scattered in the first place? Yeah, John?
There has certainly been times in my life when these were my least favorite passages in the entire Word of God.
Yes.
And I wanted to put like a little white piece of paper over that part.
Or take the scissors.
Yeah.
This is a, but there's something written on the back of it too. You can't quite do that.
You got to keep going.
Yeah, this is not what we want to hear when we're in the middle of a trial, is it? Be steadfast. And one thing I should say is probably be careful about offering advice. Like this is something that people are going to have to hear James say to us about things and learn from it that way. Let's move to the second idea that Brother Feeney just mentioned here. When you're facing either a trial or a temptation, pray for wisdom. What is wisdom? What would be a Bible definition of wisdom? Wisdom mean being smart?
No.
Guidance.
All right. What you know.
So you're actually asking, in order to do what wisdom does, you have to pray for wisdom. Jan, you defined it a minute ago there.
The ability to use what you know.
All right.
Yeah. Knowledge.
All right. It's the proper use of knowledge. Brian, were you going to add to it? Okay. One of the definitions that I appreciate, it actually comes from when Solomon made his request to God. He wanted to have the ability to discern what was good from what was evil. And a way in which wisdom might be prayed for with that definition would be, Father, help me to do what would be best. That's a prayer for wisdom when you think about it. Now, look what James says here. What kind of attitude toward God does it take to pray for wisdom? All right, it has to be a view toward God as the source of wisdom. That would be first.
Humility.
All right, the humility that I don't know everything here and I need guidance. What else?
Without doubting.
All right, that God wants to answer that request and will. Now, this is an important distinction right here. How does knowledge come?
Study.
All right, study. Now, when you are in the middle of a trial, why is study not sufficient advice?
Can't think straight sometimes.
All right. We grin about that, but that's exactly the point, though, isn't it? When you're in the middle of a trial, and thinking that you can study your way through it, and I'm not saying don't read the Lord's Word and study and think about it, but it's a little bit like trying to push down the accelerator on your car when you need to speed up. That's not the time to gas it up. You need to have some fuel in the tank already. And the difference between knowledge and wisdom is that you get in situations where you have to live on the knowledge you have. What you pray to God for is the ability to use that knowledge well and to make good choices and to handle the situation.
And
now,
it's not a one-time pray.
No, it's not. That's a constant prayer. Now, what promise is attached to this instruction here?
It'll be given to him.
All right, God.
Liberally.
Very good. God. It says here is that He is a God who you don't have to worry about you having to get grudging blessings from Him. He wants to bless His children with wisdom. Now, what caution is added to this instruction?
Not wavering.
All right. The man who prays for wisdom has to ask in faith, without any wavering or doubting or so forth. And the illustration he uses about doubting is instability of water with the waves blasting or the wind blasting upon it. And the wind might be the trial, and the person who is wavering, he's not sure if God's for him or against him, and he's not sure if God will answer his prayer or not. And he has to see the results from his prayer immediately, or he won't keep on praying. The thing about trials that we mentioned is they're not comfortable. They're not what we want to go through. And the thing about praying for wisdom in the middle of the trial, it's not like you pray to God and the light comes on and you know exactly what to do right now. When do you know that you had wisdom in the middle of a trial and God answered your prayer? Unfortunately, when you're on the other, when you've been through it, when God's been through it with you.
I think most of the time we think our knowledge is better than God's wisdom. Oh. Ask Him for wisdom. But then, I'm pretty smart, God. I've read that book for 50 years, 60 years. And I think I know, but I don't know the same as He does. Mine's just a minor thing.
All right, it's a wise point, though, that what's the proof that most of the time we think our knowledge is better than God's wisdom?
Because
we don't pray about it. We don't ask, right? I think that's the idea. A double-minded man, it says, the double-minded man is the fella who wants to pray and then run things himself. is unstable in all his ways. That makes sense. If you try to be on both sides, you waver back and forth. You can't decide what you're going to depend on. That becomes a part of it. Now, we'll run out of time. Let me more quickly show you these points, and then we'll have to come back to them a little bit later on. The other paragraphs. Notice in verses 9 through 11 the caution against pride. That's right, and especially pride of a certain sort. Pride occasioned by what?
Riches
or possessions. And so, how would you state this principle with regard to handling trials and temptations? How would you sum up verses 9 through 11, the point it makes with regard to trials and temptations? There are other applications that we'll get to later on, but...
Your money isn't going to get you through.
All right. Now...
And neither will it last.
Do what?
If
you have a broken water pipe, it might help. I can't argue that point. So. Chatty, what did you say?
Talking about the flower of the field, it's not going to last forever
either. All right. That's where I'm headed is with this is you try to depend on or look to... You could use look to here. Depend upon what is permanent. And this is a part of humility, by the way, if you think about it. You don't think that just because you have money that you're above trials. Why?
You just follow the ladder.
That's right. It will
help temporarily.
All right, it'll help temporarily, but it won't last. I mean, you may have invested with what was the Madoff? Would you ever invest your money with a guy named Madoff?
Be Madoff
now. I've thought about what was the doctor here in town, Doctor Bone Break.
Yeah.
I've always thought there's a chiropractor named Dr. Harshman. You know, would you? I wonder if I'd go to those. But anyway, that's a different point. The one thing about money is, first, it won't help, and will there ever be trials that you go through? Now, some of them, like Brother Feeney said, it helped to have some rich friends. But will there be trials that you go through that money can't...
Absolutely.
What will be some of them? Well, we named some of them earlier, didn't we?
Sickness,
loneliness, age. Fred Wilson told me this getting old ain't for sissies. He said.
It's for the birds.
Okay. You know that there are... And this poor fella has been... He brought it on himself, but he's been used for all kinds of illustrations. You've seen Tiger Woods' yacht on the news over the last 2 weeks. Probably is not bringing a great deal of peace of mind, is it?
Yeah.
Yeah. And that's the point he's making. On the other hand, how does this point help you in the middle of some trials? If the advice is to be steadfast under trial, how does realizing verses 9 through 11 even help Brother Feeney with his broken water pipe?
Could be worse.
Could be worse. And may get worse. I don't know. No, that's a little direction of where I'm headed. Let me, all right.
We can always go to Linda's house.
All right. At Green Forest, years ago, I was going through, I don't remember, this kind of proves the guy's point, but I don't remember what the problem was, but I was whining to a friend of mine, an old boy, about something going on in my life at the time. It seems to be a common characteristic with me, but anyway, he said, "Ah, in 100 years, nobody will even remember." And there is some truth to that, isn't there? All right. In fact, I don't remember, John.
Well, and the real one at the end is that if you endure, what do you get?
All right. This is a good thing to end the class on today. What do you get?
Crown of life.
Crown of life, he says. Verse 12. You remain steadfast. You stand the test. You receive the crown of life, which God has promised to those who love Him. So, it's worth it. That's the point I was going to bring up. It's worth it. We'll try to finish up this discussion next week. Everybody have a Merry Christmas time, a really happy holiday, okay? Everybody, we'll see you next Lord's Day.